Plantation owners of Cuba and Louisiana are amongst the most elegant gentlemen that you could find outside the court of St. James, she reminded him. I am prepared to accept his word as a gentleman, Zuga snapped. Are you not a little eager, Zuga? She asked with a deceptive sweetness. But his tone had kindled sparks in her eyes, like the green lights in an emerald. Would it not seriously impede your plans to find ourselves shipped on board a slaver? Damn me, woman, I have his word. Zuga was getting truly angry now. St. John is engaged in legitimate trade. He hopes for a cargo of ivory and palm oil. Have you asked to inspect the ship's hold? He has given his word. Will you ask him to open the holds? Zuga hesitated. His gaze wavered a moment, and then he made his decision. No, I will not, he said flatly. That would be an insult to him, and quite rightly, he would resent it. And if we found what you were afraid to find, it would discredit the purpose of our expedition, she agreed. As the leader of this mission, I have made the decision. Papa would never let anything stand in his way either, not even Mama or the family. Sissy, if you still feel that way when we reach the Cape, I will arrange for passage on another vessel to Mozambique. Will that satisfy you? She did not reply, but continued to stare at him with a flat, accusing gaze. If we did find evidence, he waved his hands with agitation, what could we do about it? We could make a sworn deposition to the Admiralty at Cape Town. Sissy, he sighed wearily at her intransigence, don't you understand? If I were to challenge St. John, we could gain nothing. If the accusation is unwarranted, we would place ourselves in a damned awkward position. And if, in the very unlikely event that this ship is equipped for the trade, we would then be in considerable danger. Do not underestimate that danger, Robin. St. John is a determined man. He stopped and shook his head decisively, the fashionable curls dangling over his ears. I am not going to endanger you, myself, or the whole expedition. That is my decision, and I will insist that you abide by it. After a long pause, Robin slowly dropped her gaze to her hands and intermeshed her fingers. Very well, Zuga. His relief was obvious. I'm grateful for your compliance, my dear. He stooped over her and kissed her forehead. Let me escort you to dinner. She was about to refuse, to tell him she was tired, and that once again she would dine alone in her cabin. And then an idea struck her, and she nodded. Thank you, Zuga, she told him, and then looked up with one of those sudden smiles, so brilliant, so warm, and so rare, as to disarm him completely. I am fortunate to have such a handsome dinner companion. She sat between Mungo St. John and her brother, and had her brother not known better, he might have suspected her of flirting outrageously with the captain. She was all smiles and sparkles, leaning forward attentively to listen whenever he spoke, recharging his glass whenever it was less than half filled with wine, and laughing delightedly at his dry sallies. Zuga was amazed and a little alarmed by the transformation. While St. John had never seen her like this, he had covered his original surprise with an amused half-smile. However, in this mood, Robin Ballantyne was an attractive companion. Her stubborn, rather sharp face softened to the edge of prettiness, while her best features, her hair, her perfect skin, her eyes and fine white teeth, gleamed and flashed in the lamplight. Mungo St. John's own mood became expansive. He laughed more readily, and his interest was clearly piqued. With Robin plying his glass, he drank more than on any other night of the voyage, and when his steward served a good plum duff, he called for a bottle of brandy to wash it down. Zuga had also been infected by the strangely festive air of the dinner, and he protested as vigorously as St. John when suddenly Robin declared herself to be exhausted and stood up from the board. But she was adamant. In her cabin she could still hear the occasional shouts of laughter from the saloon, and she went quietly about her preparations. She slid the locking bar into place to assure her privacy. Then she knelt beside her chest and wormed her way down to the bottom layers, from which she retrieved a pair of man's moleskin breeches, a flannel shirt and cravat, with a high-bottomed monkey jacket to go over them and well-worn half-boots. This had been her uniform and her disguise as a medical student at St. Matthew's Hospital. Now she stripped herself naked and for a moment enjoyed the wicked freedom of the feeling, even indulging herself to the extent of gazing down at her nudity. She was not too certain if it was a sin to enjoy one's own body, but she suspected that it was. Nevertheless, she persisted. Her legs were straight and strong. Her hips flared with a graceful curve and then narrowed abruptly into her waist. Her belly was almost flat with just an interesting little bulge below the navel. Now, here was definitely sinful ground. Of this there was no doubt. But still she could not deny the temptation to let her gaze linger a moment. She understood fully the technical purpose and the physical workings of all her body's highly complicated machinery, both visible and concealed. It was only the feelings and emotions which sprang from this source which both confused and worried her, for they had taught her none of this at St. Matthew's. She paused and passed on hurriedly to safer ground, lifting her arms to pile the tresses of her hair onto the top of her head and hold them in place with a soft cloth cap. Her breasts were round and neat as ripening apples, so firm as hardly to change their shape as she moved her arms. Their resemblance to fruit pleased her, and she spent a few moments longer than was necessary in adjusting the cloth cap upon her head, looking down at them. But there was a limit to self-indulgence, and she swept the flannel shirt over her head, pulled the tails down around her waist, stepped into the breeches. How good they felt again, after so long in those hobbling skirts. And then, sitting upon the bunk, she pulled on the half-boots and buckled the ankle straps of the breeches under the arch of her foot, before standing to clinch the belt at her waist. She opened her black valise, took out the roll of surgical instruments, and selected one of the sturdier scalpels, folding out the blade and testing it with her thumb. It was stingingly sharp. She closed the blade and slipped it into her hip pocket. It was the only weapon available to her. She was ready now, and she closed the shutter on the bull's-eye lantern, darkening the cabin completely before climbing, fully dressed, into her bunk, pulling the rough woolen blanket to her chin and settling down to wait. The laughter from the saloon became more abandoned, and she imagined that the brandy bottle was being cruelly punished by the men. A long while later she heard her brother's heavy, uneven footsteps on the companion way past her cabin, and then there was only the creak and pop of the ship's timbers as she heeled to the wind, and far away the regular tapping of some loose piece of equipment. She was so keyed with both fear and anticipation that there was never any danger of her falling asleep. However, the time passed with wearying slowness. Each time that she opened the shutter of the lantern to check her pocket watch, the hand seemed hardly to have moved. Then, somehow, it was 2 o'clock in the morning, the hour when the human body and spirit are at their lowest ebb. She rose quietly from her bunk, picked up the darkened lantern, and went to the door of her cabin. The locking bolt clattered like a volley of musketry, but then it was open, and she slipped through. In the saloon, a single oil lamp still burned, smokily, throwing agitated shadows against the wooden bulkheads, while the empty brandy bottle had fallen to the deck and rolled back and forth with the ship's motion. Robin squatted to pull off her boots, and leaving them at the entrance, she went forward on bare feet, crossed the saloon, and stepped into the passageway that led to the stern quarters. Her breath was short, as though she had run far, and she paused to lift the shutter of the bull's-eye lantern and flash a narrow beam of light into the darkness ahead. The door to Mungo St. John's cabin was closed. She crept towards it, guiding herself with one hand on the bulkhead, and at last her fingers closed over the brass door handle. "Please God," she whispered, and achingly slowly twisted the handle. It turned easily, and then the door slid open an inch along its track, enough for her to peep through into the cabin beyond. There was just light to see, for the deck above was pierced for a repeating compass, so that even while in his bunk, the master could at a glance tell his ship's heading. The compass was lit by the dull yellow glow of the helmsman's lantern, and the reflection allowed Robin to make out the cabin's central features. The bunk was screened off by a dark curtain, and the rest of the furnishings were simple. The locked doors of the arms chest to the left, with a row of hooks beyond from which hung a coat, and the clothing that St. John had been wearing at dinner. Facing the door was a solid teak desk, with racks to hold the brass navigational instruments, sextant, straight-edge dividers, and on the bulkhead above it were affixed the barometer and the ship's chronometer. The captain had evidently emptied his pockets onto the desktop before undressing. Scattered amongst the charts and ship's papers were a clasp knife, a silver cigar case, a tiny gold inlaid pocket pistol of the type favoured by professional gamblers, a pair of chunky ivory dice — Zuga and St. John must have fallen to gaming again after she left them — and then, most important, what she had hoped to find, the bunch of ship's keys that St. John usually wore on a chain from his belt, lay in the centre of the desk. An inch at a time, Robin slid the door further open, watching the dark alcove to the right of the cabin. The curtains billowed slightly with each roll of the ship, and she screwed her nerves tighter as she imagined the movement to be that of a man about to leap out at her. When the door was open enough to allow her to pass through, it required a huge effort of will to take the first step. Halfway across the cabin, she froze. Now she was only inches from the bunk. She peered into the narrow gap in the curtaining and saw the gleam of naked flesh and heard the deep, regular breathing of the sleeping man. It reassured her, and she went on swiftly to the desk. She had no way of learning which keys fitted the lazaretto and the hatch to the main hold. She had to take the whole heavy bunch and realize that it would mean returning to the cabin later. She did not know if she would have the courage to do that, and as she lifted the bunch, her hand shook so it jangled sharply. Startled, she clutched it to her bosom and stared fearfully at the alcove. There was no movement beyond the curtains, and she glided back towards the door on silent bare feet. It was only when the door closed again that the curtains of the alcove were jerked open, and Mungo St. John lifted himself on one elbow. He paused only a moment, and then swung his legs out of the bunk and stood up. He reached the desk in two quick strides and checked the top. "The keys," he hissed, and reached out for his breeches hanging on the rack beside him, pulling them on swiftly, and then stooping to open one of the drawers in his desk. He lifted the lid of the rosewood case and took out the pair of long-barreled dueling pistols, thrust them into his waistband, and started for the door of the cabin. Robin found the correct key to the lazaretto on the third attempt, and the door gave reluctantly, dragging on the hinge with a squeal that sounded to her like a bugle call commanding a charge of heavy cavalry. She locked the door behind her again, feeling a rush of relief to know that nobody could follow her now, and she opened the shutter of the lantern and looked about her swiftly. The lazaretto was no more than a large cupboard used as a pantry for the officer's personal stores. Sides of smoked ham and dried polonies hung from hooks on the deck above. There were fat rounds of cheese in the racks, boxes of tinned goods, racks of black bottles with waxed stoppers, bags of flour and rice, and facing Robin, another hatch, with the locking bar chained in place by a padlock the size of her doubled fists.